True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
In 2006, Jeffrey Deskovic's indictment, charging him with the rape and murder of a high school classmate, was dismissed on the grounds of actual innocence. Post-conviction DNA testing proved his innocence. It also identified the real killer. When a classmate of 16-year-old Jeffrey was found raped and murdered in a local park, he was understandably upset. The police, though, said that his behavior seemed odd. They were suspicious of him because he was late for school the day after the murder, and he seemed overly distraught about the death of a girl who wasn't even really a friend of his. Jeffrey was questioned at length and eventually manipulated into giving a false confession. Since his release from prison, Jeffrey has earned his law degree and established the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, devoting his life to fighting wrongful convictions and helping those exonerated to reclaim their lives. Join us at the quiet end for the story of Jeffrey Deskovic. Dick was able to be in touch with Mr. Deskovic for an interview recently, and we hope you'll find what he had to say as fascinating as we did.
So we're going to do a beer review, of course. When I had done the interview with Mr. Deskovic, I asked him if he had a favorite beer. He said, not really. Do you review ciders?
And I said, that's a no-no.
I said, nah, exactly. So I told him I'd get him a nice beer. I did, I think. This is Bon Bon 2X TNT Double IPA. That's quite a mouthful.
It is, really.
It's from Single Cut Beer Smiths in Queens, New York.
Yeah, and he said he's been there quite a bit. He actually goes to Queens often, so it works.
Yes, so that's kind of why I did it. It's a New England IPA, so we're going to expect more of a fruity rather than a hoppy beer. And this is a pretty nice one. It's a hazy gold color. Poured it into our True Crime Brewery snifter. There was a pretty nice size white head with a fair amount of lacing on the glass. The aroma was like I thought, mostly citrus, some tropical fruit. Taste was even better than the aroma. Grapefruit, some lemon, some mango. Late in the swallow, in the taste, a little bit of pine. This is a nicely balanced double IPA. Fruity. Enjoy it. We're going to open it up.
All right. I am looking forward to it. Hopefully not too much pine. So let's open it.
No, it's just a touch of it. So don't worry. You're going to be impressed with the fruit.
All right, Dickie, come on down to the quiet end and let's talk just a little bit and then we'll play your interview.
Okay.
So why don't you give me just like the basic background of what happened and then we'll listen to the interview. Set it up for us.
Well, we got to go back a few years. In November of 1989, Jeffrey Deskovic's Peekskill, New York high school classmate, Angela Correa, who was 15, was raped, beaten, and strangled to death. Detectives decided that Jeffrey had been unusually upset at Angela's memorials, and they misinterpreted his desire to help solve the crime as a sign of his guilt. After speaking with him several times over the next couple 3 weeks, and they were actually feeding him information about the case, they brought him in for a polygraph. So this kid now, he's 17, he'd never been in trouble with the law before. He was interrogated for over 7 hours without a lawyer or a parent present. Detectives were quite aggressive with him. They lied to him about failing a polygraph.
Yeah, it's just so much to even imagine, being alone at that age and going through that. I mean, I think at that age, with professional detectives who know what they're doing, pretty much anyone could be led into a false confession. They could even make you believe you did it for a while, right?
Yeah, they can. I thought there were laws, maybe it's state by state, but I thought you couldn't question a minor without a parent present.
I don't think that's true. I think in Europe that's a law. We talked about that with one case. That in the U.S., I don't believe it's a law. I could be wrong. It might be state by state. But as far as I know, there's no law that says a 17-year-old needs to have a lawyer or a parent present. I mean, it seems like the ethical thing to do.
Right. But apparently, well, I guess it couldn't have been a law because he was interviewed and interrogated by himself.
Exactly. And as we know, the police are allowed to lie to you. So they can say anything to you, really, to lead you down the wrong path. And I think, as he told you during the interview, they were kind of telling him he could go home if he just told them what they wanted.
They basically said, you tell us what we want to hear, we'll let you go home. So he did. He confessed, and they arrested him. He didn't get to go home. In fact, after he confessed, the very next day he recanted his confession. He said he was coerced into confessing. But that was too late for him, at least in the eyes of the police.
Sure, yeah. They've got it. And nothing was recorded either. So it's the early 90s. We already had the capability to record video and audio in the 90s. So there's no excuse for not recording it, other than they didn't want some things to come out. It's the way I see it.
Understandably, here he is being charged with murder. He's feeling, I'm sure, like the police lied to him. They told him if he just told them what they wanted, they'd let him go, and they didn't. He attempted suicide twice before his trial began.
That's incredibly sad.
It is. Knowing you had nothing to do with it, and you're going to be on trial for murder.
Well, yeah, and it almost seems like he was being punished for being sensitive and being manipulated.
Right.
Yeah.
So in January of 1991, in the trial, he ended up being convicted of first-degree rape and second-degree murder. Now, this was despite the fact that the DNA results showed that it was not his semen in the rape kit that was gathered from Angela's body. So I'm just kind of flabbergasted about that. I mean, I thought DNA trumped everything, right?
Well, I think that that would be something that should get in the way of convicting him, yes.
Well, it didn't, and he'll discuss that in the interview. But it's not his DNA. Yes, he confessed, but then he recanted the confession. I don't see how they could even go to trial, but...
Well, and all they really had was the confession. He actually had an alibi as well.
He did. Now, from the start, Deskovic maintained his innocence. The other fact of it is that he was innocent, and so he's serving time for this crime he didn't commit. The real killer was still roaming around. And here's the hard part. He killed a second person, as we'll find out.
Tragic.
So Jeffrey continued to maintain his innocence for years, and he eventually exhausted all his appeals. He had appealed originally to the Westchester County District Attorney, who was Jeanine Pirro at the time, and he kept asking her to do post-conviction DNA testing, and she repeatedly declined. Now, despite all these setbacks, he didn't just languish in prison. He continued to pursue his education. He earned his GED in prison. He got an associate's degree in prison. And he completed 1 year of college in prison.
Well, and I think from what he said, he would have done more.
He would have done more.
Except the program was cut.
The funding was cut.
Well, eventually the Innocence Project became interested in his case, and they provided him with a competent defense attorney. In 2006, the newly elected district attorney, Janet DeFiore, authorized the DNA testing, and the testing again excluded Jeffrey Deskovic, but it matched the DNA of a man who was already in prison for another murder, and this man, Stephen Cunningham, confessed to the murder of Angela Correa.
Okay, so as you had said earlier, his conviction was overturned, and Deskovic was freed from prison in 2006. He graduated from college, he attended law school, and he received his JD in 2019.
So it took some time. There were some dark times there. I mean, it's easy to sum it up in a sentence or two, but he went through an awful lot.
Yeah, he said first 5 years out of prison were very, very difficult.
I imagine.
But he persevered.
And now he works as an advocate for reform of the criminal justice system. And he gives speeches, he publishes articles, and of course he heads the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. which has so far won the release of 7 people wrongfully convicted of serious crimes. So that's impressive to me.
Me too.
And according to an opinion piece in The Spectrum written by Michelle Malkin, it's his willingness to reach out to law enforcement and enlighten them, instead of just demonizing them, that has made him an invaluable leader in criminal justice reform. So Lieutenant Michael Devine of the Bergen County Law and Public Safety Institute was really impressed. So impressed, in fact, with Deskovic's presentations to correction recruits that he was allowed to become a certified instructor for the New Jersey Police Training Commission.
And then Dr. Kevin Barrett, who's a 32-year veteran of the Englewood, New Jersey Police Department and chairman of the Criminal Justice Department at Rockland Community College, said that his students were mesmerized by Mr. Deskovic's presentation, and they will carry the lessons they learned from him for the next 25 years of their careers. That's pretty high praise indeed, isn't it?
Very high praise.
So I was able to speak with Mr. Deskovic in a Zoom meeting. The interview was quite enlightening. He's a good speaker, can tell stories. Not that he was making up stories, but he...
he's a talker.
He's a talker, and he presents himself nicely. I think he'd be fun to listen to, giving a lecture.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, not just what he's been through, but also the way that he's dealt with it is impressive.
Certainly is.
So let's go ahead and listen to your interview. Then we'll follow up after.
See you on the other side. I'm interviewing Jeffrey Deskovic, who has a harrowing tale to tell us about. Thank you for joining us today, Jeffrey.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Before we get into the grisly details of what happened to you, let's hear a little bit about your early life.
Yeah, I was, when I grew up in an apartment complex in Peekskill in Westchester County, New York, which was the suburb. So I would say that my early life was, it was pretty fun, actually. I was one of the two main kids in the apartment complex, and pretty much whatever I would suggest would be what we would do. I mean, from playing basketball to swimming to playing stickball and riding bikes and playing Monopoly and video games and all of that. So that was my life, like outside of school. Whereas in school, I didn't quite fit in. So I was like quiet to myself, and I didn't, you know, I was kind of on the fringes of the society. I mean, all the kids there were older than I was, since I had skipped a grade in grade school.
You had, wow. So you were kind of a shy and, shall we say, gawky kid?
I would say that. Yes, I would. That's a great description.
Okay. And how did you know Angela Correa?
She was a classmate in two of my classes as a freshman, one as a sophomore. I knew her name. She knew mine. That was pretty much the extent of it.
So you weren't like good friends or anything?
No. No, I wouldn't even say that we were on a high-by basis.
So you didn't know her very well, just someone you acknowledged that was in the same classes. Acquaintances, classmates, whatever.
Yes, I agree with all those, yes.
Okay. And tell me about the crime. What happened to her?
So she was found in Hillcrest Park. She was found naked from the waist down, so... per the police, she was murdered and she was raped. She actually had been assigned to take some photographs of greenery by her photography class teacher, who had implemented like a buddy system where male students were matched with the female students. But the male student who was supposed to accompany her skipped out on the assignment. And for some reason, she decided to go to the park by herself. I mean, as I understand it, this was the only time she really went anywhere unless she was accompanied by her older sister or her parents, keeping in mind her background. I mean, she was an immigrant from Colombia. She had been in the country just for a year and a half.
So she was pretty new.
She was pretty new.
And is this park, is it considered a safe place?
Up until that point, it was considered to be a safe place, yes.
And so she was found nude from the waist down?
Yes.
How had she been killed?
She had been, the medical examiner wasn't 100% clear. I mean, he had said that she had been asphyxiated, but he also had mentioned that she suffered a severe wound being hit from something on the back of her head. So it's not clear to me which of the two was the way she died.
And how did you start to become a suspect in all this?
Because a few ways. So the police interviewed a lot of students from the high school, and some of them told the police that they might want to talk to me because I didn't fit in. So I guess the theory is that the shy, gawky kids commit ghastly crimes. I guess that was the theory. So that was one thing. And then the police made a big to-do. It was really my first brush with death. And, you know, so I was emotional, and they felt like my emotional reaction was some sort of expression of internal remorse that I felt for what I had done. And then a third thing, which doesn't really make a lot of sense, because this really had shook up Peekskill. I mean, there hadn't been a murder there in approximately 20 years. And so it shook the whole city up to the point that free mental health counseling was offered to anybody who wanted it. And lastly, the police got a psychological profile from the NYPD, which purported to have the psychological characteristics of the actual perpetrator. And I had the misfortune of matching those characteristics.
Huh. So it was pseudoscience that captured you.
Yes, that was part of it, sure. That's what put me on their radar, yes.
And we know from looking at different cases that once they zero in on a suspect, that they sort of develop tunnel vision.
Exactly right, yes.
And so if you're the suspect, they're going to work hard to make sure you're implicated.
That's correct.
So they bring you in to interview?
They did, yes. And, you know, they showed me some photographs of her, and they, you know, they accused me of the crime. I mean, they didn't arrest me for it, but they verbally accused me. And, you know, they were kind of roughhousing me psychologically and, you know, to trying to get me to confess to the crime. And then when I wanted to leave, then they changed up their tune. And, you know, Jeff as the junior detective investigator helper theme was advanced by them. And so for the next 6 weeks, they played this cat and mouse game with me, in which half the time they spoke to me as if I was a suspect. And then the other half the time, they would pretend like they needed my help to solve the crime. So before I was a teenager, I actually wanted to be a cop. So this unexpected early opportunity to do this quasi-police work, along with my age, which was 16, was how they were able to pull the wool over my eyes. You know, they would say things like, you know, the kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Stop in from time to time. They'd ask me opinion questions and congratulate me that my opinions were correct. You know, they made me feel important. They did the good cop, bad cop routine. And, you know, and I began to look to the officer who was pretending to be my friend as a father figure, because my father had never been involved in my life in any capacity.
And the whole time you were on your own.
That's correct. The same thing for all the rest of the interviews that happened over the next 6 weeks. Correct.
And most of the time you're thinking that you're helping them.
That's right.
They're seeking your help.
Yes. And then they would switch up and they'd start, you know, accusing me and asking me questions like they thought I committed the crime. And that would always confuse me. And then when they would push too hard on that thing, they would go back to the Jeff is the junior detective investigator theme. And so they kept me off balance psychologically and, you know, mentally. And, you know, I was 16 years old and they were adults. They were overreaching me.
So they got the confession from you eventually.
Yes, eventually they did. So just to put a little bit of color to that, they got me to agree to the test by telling me that some new information came into their file and they wanted to share that with me. And that would allow me to be more helpful to them. But first I would have to take and pass a polygraph. So the next day, instead of going to school, I went to the police station. My mother and grandmother did not know where I was. They drove me across county lines from Peekskill in Westchester County to the town of Brewster, which is in Putnam County. So it was about 40 minutes away by car. So now I was totally dependent upon them. And they gave me a 4-page brochure, which explained how the polygraph worked, but I didn't understand it. But then I thought, I'm there to help the police. So, you know, what does it matter? The polygraphist himself was a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator who was dressed as a civilian. He was, you know, he never identified himself as a police officer. He gave me countless cups of coffee. He put me in a small room and attached a polygraph machine to me. And then he launched into his third degree tactics, which, you know, featured him raising his voice at me, invading my personal space, asking me the same questions over and over again. And he kept that routine up for 6.5 to 7 hours. You know, keeping in mind that I wasn't used to talking to adult males since my father wasn't involved in my life. And I had minimal interaction with my family, the adults. So I wasn't used to talking to grown men is what the point is. Yeah. And eventually he told me, you know, what do you mean you didn't do it? You told me through the test results that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And that's when the officer who had been pretending to be my friend. He came in the room and told me that the other officers were going to harm me, that he couldn't hold them off any longer, that I would have to, you know, just help myself. Then he added, if I did as they wanted, and I just told them what did as they wanted, and I just, you know, gave them that story they were looking for, that they'd stop what they're doing, that I could go home, that I was not going to be arrested. So being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, not thinking about the long term, I was only concerned with my safety in the moment. I was in fear of my life. The fact that I didn't know where I was and no one else knew where I was either loomed very large in my mind. And, you know, then there was that false promise. So I made the decision to make up a story based on the information they had given me that day and in the 6 weeks run up to it. And, you know, by the time it was all said and done, I was curled up into a fetal position on the floor. I was crying uncontrollably. Obviously, I was, in fact, arrested and charged with a murder and rape.
Yeah, they got their confession.
Correct.
Wow. So it would seem that any competent defense attorney would take care of that.
Yes, I agree with you. So first off, a DNA test result came in from the FBI lab before I went to trial, which showed that semen found in the victim didn't match me. But instead of acknowledging they made a mistake, they continued to prosecute full speed ahead. In order to explain away the DNA, the prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit fraud. He claimed 6 months after doing the autopsy, he claimed that he remembered suddenly that he forgot to document medical evidence, which he said showed that the victim had been sexually active. Basically, they accused her of sleeping around, and that was their way of explaining that the semen didn't come from me. He mentioned a specific other high school classmate that he claimed that slept with the victim, that he said it was that person's semen, but he never had a DNA test performed to prove that. He never called him even as a witness. That's where my lawyer's failings, as we started off at, you asked me, came in. So my lawyer never interviewed or called as a witness my alibi. I was actually playing wiffle ball when the crime happened. He never cross-examined the medical examiner to expose his fraud. He never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA not matching me and used that to argue that that proved that this confession obtained under highly questionable circumstances was coerced and false. He rarely met with me. He should have never represented me because of a conflict of interest. So this other youth that the prosecutor was falsely claiming had slept with the victim, he was represented by another member of Westchester County Legal Aid. So that conflict of interest prevented the defense from calling him as a witness to explode that myth. It prevented the defense from asking him for a DNA sample. When I hadn't decided if I was going to have a bench trial, it was decided by a judge or a jury trial, my lawyer came to me one day and said that the judge told him off the record to pick a jury because he didn't want to be responsible for finding me not guilty. My lawyer was supposed to put that on the record and ask him to recuse himself because it wasn't proper for him to narrow my options like that. You know, and it suggests that he was feeling public pressure because every time I went to the court appearance, it was like a major media moment from virtually all of the coverage, guilt presumptive oriented. And the last thing I'll mention is that, you know, the interrogation was not videotaped or audio taped and there was no signed confession. It was just the officer's word for it. And they left the threat and false promise out of their testimony. So I wanted to testify as to those facts at the pre-trial hearing, but he wouldn't let me. You know, had I done so and the judge believed me, then the statements would have been ruled as involuntary and therefore not admissible. But he wouldn't allow me to. He said he hadn't decided if I was going to testify at the trial or not. And he didn't want to have me on the record prior to that testimony if that was to happen. But then when I got to the trial, he wouldn't allow me to testify there either. He told me it wasn't up to him to prove I was innocent, that it was up to me to prove, it was up to the prosecution to prove that I was guilty, and he didn't think that it happened. That's a pretty naive way to practice law, particularly in a confession, because you got to answer that confession. You got to explain that confession. You have to disprove that confession because there's a 80% conviction rate in cases that have confessions. So he didn't do any of that. And then he told me that his win-loss record was better when his clients didn't testify as compared to when they did. But most of them probably had criminal records, but I didn't. And so that really didn't apply to me. So add it all up, I was wrongfully convicted and given a 15 to life sentence, which I was sent to a men's maximum security prison to serve since I had been charged as an adult.
It just gets more Kafka-esque. You're not able to refute the confession.
Right.
Because your lawyer said, we don't need to do that, or I don't want you to do that.
Right.
God. So you were found guilty and sentenced.
Yes.
In this big time prison.
Correct.
How'd that work?
Well, it was very, not very well. It was very dangerous there. You know, at times I was beat up. One time I was nearly killed. I mean, there's a vigilante mentality towards people who've been convicted of sex offenses in prison. So, you know, I had this target on my back. And, you know, I'm 17 years old. I'm in a men's maximum security prison. I mean, let's be for real. How am I going to defend myself against, you know, grown adults, many of whom are guilty of committing violent crimes? I had to fight off feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, thoughts of giving up, suicidal ideation. So that went on in addition to the physical part of it. And en route to when I was eventually exonerated, I mean, I lost 7 appeals and I got turned down for parole.
So you're battling to stay alive in prison. When did you decide you needed to fight the conviction?
Right away. As soon as I was convicted, you know, I realized that. I mean, it was after the fact that I realized that, you know, my lawyer really put up very little to no fight, you know, so I didn't trust lawyers anymore to defend me. You know, I felt like I needed to try to be a little bit more proactive than that. It was an old timer in the prison that told me, look, you got to go to the law library and learn the law and stay on top of your lawyer and give suggestions when you can. And so that's what I did. You know, I used to go to the law library. I used to learn the law. I used to collect articles about other people who were exonerated in order to keep my morale up. And I was trying to study who helped them and what route did they take. You know, I did things to avoid my time being in prison being a total waste. I mean, I got GED. I got an associate's. I completed a year towards the bachelor's before funding was cut. I completed a lot of vocational programs as well while I was there. And I used to read from 1998 forward, I read 3 to 4 nonfiction books a week, you know, just trying to do stuff to learn. And that was all in addition to writing letters looking for help. I mean, I was trying to find an attorney and an investigator to take my case once my appeals were exhausted.
And the whole time you were on your own. Did you have legal representation as you were?
I did throughout the appeals process. So I'd just like to put a little bit of color just in a concise way to the appeals because the injustice continued at the post-conviction level. So my lawyer, argued that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence, that the prosecution hadn't proven guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that there was legally insufficient evidence to find me guilty. You know, all that was wrapped around the DNA and the lack of evidence other than this confession. She argued that the confession was coerced and false. And then she argued 6 other issues of law. So the appellate division, they ruled that the confession was voluntary and that, you know, I had been free to come and go as I wanted. And then they ruled that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, which is kind of a head scratcher considering that they had no evidence and the DNA didn't match me. They got rid of all of my other arguments in one sentence by ruling that they had looked at my remaining contentions and found them either to be not preserved for review or else not having any merit. They ruled against me 5-0. It was all downhill from there, even worse. So the re-argument motion was denied in one word. Denied Court of Appeals declined to give me permission to appeal to them. I lost in federal court because the court clerk gave my lawyers the wrong information on the filing procedure, which caused my petition to arrive 4 days too late, which the district attorney, Janine Pero, her office took the position that the 4 days were prejudicial to the people. So then I got time barred. I challenged that ruling at the U.S. Court of Appeals, which included future U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. They upheld that ruling. They declined my re-argument motion. And the U.S. Supreme Court declined to give me permission to appeal to them. So I wrote letters for them. Once your appeals are over, the only way back into court is if you can find some previously unknown evidence of innocence or unless there's been some retroactive change in the law. So I wrote a lot of letters looking for help, rarely getting responses. Then I went to the parole board, and in part because I maintained my innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility, I was denied parole as well. Ultimately, I was exonerated through further DNA testing that I got through with the Innocence Project's help, and it not only reaffirmed the prior negative result, but it identified the actual perpetrator.
They identified him because his DNA was in the system?
Correct. Left free while I was doing time for his crime. He killed the second victim 3.5 years later, who was a school teacher and had 2 children. So all of my charges were dismissed on actual innocence grounds, whereas he was arrested for and charged with the ultimately convicted of killing the victim in my case.
So do you get the impression that if there wasn't a match with his DNA, you might still be in prison?
Without a doubt.
If they do that and they can't find whose DNA it is, tough luck for you.
Yeah, exactly right, which, you know, it's a really bothersome thing, you know, about the system. That's really what bothers me so much, is that it was a series of fluke incidents that nobody could rely on, you know, from winding up with the Innocence Project's help to the DA leaving office to getting lucky that the actual criminal committed another crime and gotten caught for that.
Amazing set of circumstances that finally exonerated you and got you freed.
Correct, yes.
Just like that. And then what happens?
Yeah, so I was released immediately with nothing. And it was a very tough existence for about 5 years. So New York State has a compensation statute where you can sue for compensation. And you can, you know, I did that. And I also had a federal lawsuit filed. But, you know, that it took about 5 years before I got anything. So, you know, it was very difficult going. So I was always passed over for gainful employment. You know, I lacked stability of housing. And at one point I was a couple of weeks from a homeless shelter. Technology had passed me by, you know, internet, GPS, different methods of banking. These things didn't, cell phones, all those things did not exist before, you know. I had long since lost touch with all my former friends, and, you know, and same with my extended family as well. So I was essentially by myself, and I had to deal with the psychological after effects of the experience. I mean, it's common for people to have post-traumatic stress disorder, panic attacks, anxiety, fear on seeing law enforcement, feeling of having been frozen in time, a feeling of having of processing things at a slower speed than everyone else. So it was very difficult. And then the fact that I had went in prison at 17 posed a particular difficulty. So, you know, I had never before had a license. So I had to get a driver's license. I had never wrote a check before. I never lived on my own, and, you know, had to make ends meet. So it was very difficult, but I did start making some money sporadically doing speaking engagements. And I caught on as a weekly columnist for a newspaper, the Westchester Guardian. So that was my only consistent form of income, but it was a weekly paper. So they only wanted one article a week, you know. So thank God for, you know, Mercy College, which gave me the scholarship to finish the bachelor's. And when I lost the housing, they allowed me to live on campus. So that was how I avoided the homeless shelter. And at some point after that, a nonprofit entity called Human Development Services of Westchester, they rented an apartment for me, and I had to just give them 30% of whatever I made in the course of a month, even if that was nothing. So that was how I avoided the shelter. But, you know, I just began this advocacy trail. And that was how I made it the first 5 years.
So you hadn't decided to become an attorney then?
Yeah, well, not initially, no. But at some point, though, when I graduated with the bachelor's degree, I went towards the end of completing that, then I wanted to be an attorney. So when I graduated, I did apply to law school, having taken the entrance exam, but I didn't score very well. And I went 0-for-11. On applications to law schools. All they were looking at was the score, not me as a whole. So from there, I spent about 6 months in a dead-end job that I hated. And then I finally decided that I would get a master's degree, which I did from John Jay College. I got a master's in criminal justice. I wrote a thesis on wrongful conviction, causes, and reform. And as I mentioned, I was doing a lot of advocacy, from speaking to writing articles to doing a lot of multimedia interviews to meeting with elected officials. And then finally, I was compensated, and I decided to use some of the money to start the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, whose purpose is to free other people who are in the same position and to continue on with the policy work. So we were able to get 7 people home. We helped pass 3 laws in New York, and an advisory board member, if it could happen to you, and we helped as a coalition, and we passed another 3 laws in New York. And, you know, I also sit on the Global Advisory Council for Restorative Justice International. I advise them on wrongful conviction and criminal justice matters. So I started that, and then I made a second attempt to get into law school, and I made it in. Ironically, this time I scored an even lower score than before. But I think the law schools were hurting for students. And then on top of that, I think they were finally taking a more holistic look at students. And so they took a chance on me. So, you know, I was able to graduate Pace Law School in 2019, the law degree. And I passed the bar exam and another exam on New York law. So I'm pending admission right now. I'm waiting to get called by the Character and Fitness Committee and pass that interview and then just get the law license. And all of that is in pursuit of the dream of exonerating others as an attorney. I got tired of sitting in the front row of the courtroom. I wanted to represent some of the clients. So if I was to use a sports analogy, I was tired of being the head coach. I wanted to get on the field and play quarterback. Yes.
So, and as you said, you've already managed to exonerate 7 people.
Well, yeah, we freed 7 people, sure. Mm-hmm.
And there's more to come.
And there's more to come. Yes, we have 12 active cases right now and another 3 that are approved but are waiting. And, you know, legislatively, we're still working in New York at passing a commission on prosecutor conduct. And, you know, when the state mandated videotaping interrogations, they made some exceptions for that. The law stated that if it's a second degree murder case or a sex offense case or a drug case, it's not mandatory. So we want to try to get rid of those exceptions. And, you know, we're working in other states now with the coalition group. It could happen to you. We're not just working on those measures in New York, but we have chapters in Pennsylvania and California where we're trying to bring the oversight to prosecutors, which we passed in New York. We're trying to bring that to those states. And California, we're trying to also get rid of capital punishment because of the obvious risk of executing innocent people. And whereas in Pennsylvania, you know, they have no compensation. So they're one of 15 states that has no compensation. So we're trying to pass that with the oversight of the prosecutors, and we're trying to get automatic expungement. I mean, so there's a lot of exonerees in Pennsylvania that, although they've been exonerated in court, their records aren't cleaned. So that hinders them when it comes to for job applications and, you know, housing, applying for apartment, you know, housing, et cetera.
Your attorney who defended you, who wasn't able to adequately do that, any repercussions from that? Or possibly from the medical examiner who basically lied?
Well, there has been no repercussions for the public defender. I mean, I did sue him and the legal entity, but I mean, the Westchester Legal Aid, they paid it, not him, and it was their insurance company. Nothing happened criminally to the medical examiner or personally. I mean, I did sue him, and the county had to pay for, you know, they settled with me. I mean, he suddenly quit his job. So we found other cases where he had altered his findings to fit the prosecution theory. So he quit his job. So that was a fallout of it. The trial prosecutor suddenly retired and ran to Florida 2 weeks before I emerged. So it seems pretty clear that he was tipped off to, you know, let's look, get out of town. You know, a media storm is coming. You know, Deskovic is being exonerated. But other than that, he didn't pay for it, and neither did any of the law enforcement entities involved in coercing the confession from me. Nobody, there was no consequences to anybody. And that's one of the things that really bothers me a lot.
And then there's the whole thing about why Pirro or whoever.
Yeah, it was Pirro. Yeah, it was Jeanine Pirro. Yeah.
Why were they so reluctant to retest the DNA?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a question that every time she's asked, why didn't she do it? Why didn't she retest the DNA? Her go-to line is that she was not the district attorney when I was convicted. That's true enough, but you took office before my first appeal was decided. Your office kept the ball rolling against me. It was your office that was arguing that a negative DNA test is no insulation to a guilty verdict. You all were fighting my innocence claims. She prevented me from getting further DNA testing after she had agreed to testing and an exoneration in an unrelated Westchester County rape case, the Terry Chalmers case, where she agreed to the exoneration, and in explaining her decision publicly, she was referencing the accuracy of DNA. So based on that, I wrote her and like, well, what about this old case in the file where the DNA doesn't match me? Could you relook at the DNA? And she refused to do that. Then she fought me when I tried to get the further testing in federal court documents. So she's never taken any kind of responsibility for her role in everything.
And somewhere I read that you had even offered to pay for it yourself.
No, I didn't offer to. I didn't have any money to offer to pay for it.
But she didn't.
But she would not. Yeah. Yeah, she would not allow me to do the testing. I mean, you know, similarly, I mean, you know, Judge, you know, well, the thing that frustrates me, just one One more thing on Pirro is that in her position as a commentator on Fox News, I mean, she's this bastion of a supporter for due process. And where was all that when you were the DA? I didn't see any of that. Other people were wrongfully convicted on her watch that were later exonerated, Selwyn Days, Keon Katibi. You know, that frustrates me. And then even, you know, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, you know, she's never apologized to me. She's never made any kind of public statement. You know, it was the wrong decision that she upheld the lower federal court ruling that my being late 4 days, right, a lateness caused by misinformation by the court clerk, you know, that that was more important than my arguing my innocence as supported by a DNA test. So I tried to testify at the Senate confirmation hearings to when she was in the process of being considered for confirmation. But the issue was that her having been nominated by President Obama, the Democrats who normally would have been all over something like that, at least prior to these days, they didn't want to go against a nominee from a president of their party. And on the Republican side, again, except until recently, in general, their barriers to criminal justice reform legislation. So they weren't willing to utilize my case or me in their opposition to her. So I didn't get anywhere with that. And other than news coverage in New York that I was able to generate, I was never able to generate the national media attention that I really needed to create that firestorm to really, for them to have to call me. I mean, the AP reported on it, New York Times did, and that was pretty much it. The rest of the coverage was limited to New York.
That's some story. I can only imagine the frustration.
Yeah, but despite that, you know, I mean, I'm determined to enjoy my life as much as I can, so I'm not angry or bitter. You know, if I was to be angry or bitter, I mean, I feel like I would, in effect, be losing the rest of my life, and it's not like I would be adversely affecting anyone who was involved with what happened to me if I was angry or bitter. So, you know, the vehicle that allows me to exercise that is I doing the advocacy work. And so I take that energy and I channel it into doing the advocacy work. So, you know, this is really what I do 24/7. So I'm engaged in a lot of advocacy, from continuing to speak and doing media and multimedia interviews and meeting regularly with elected officials. And sometimes I write op-eds. And then, you know, the cases that the foundation does, you know, and then even cases that are not foundation cases, but that we, you know, support in one way or the other, whether that's grassroots tactics of helping to fill the courtroom or helping to get strategic media around cases. So if it's wrongful conviction related, pretty good chance I'm involved in it one way or another. And, you know, I've gotten some recognition for my advocacy work, and occasionally in political races where wrongful conviction and or criminal justice reform is on the plank that a candidate is running on of either party, you know, I have sometimes endorsed in those races just to further the issue and move the right people into place to try to, you know, make the justice system more accurate. So I kind of found my purpose in all of this.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Amazing.
Thank you.
So boys and girls, here's a cautionary tale for you.
Yeah, the very important thing is if the police want to speak with you, you know, you ask for a lawyer. You know, that'll level the playing field. You know, a lot of people think that they're not guilty of a crime, they don't know anything about the crime. What can possibly go wrong from speaking to the police? But I'm a real life example that quite a bit actually can go wrong. So there's that that people should know. And I believe in chasing dreams and working really, really hard in order to turn them into reality. I mean, when I was a teenager, I did want to become a lawyer. And I did ultimately do that, albeit with my life taking a much different route and, you know, many years later. But, you know, I do believe in chasing dreams, working hard. I appreciate the small things such as just freedom of movement, fresh air on my face and feeling the sunlight and just the opportunities that the world offers, just being free as contrasted with being in prison. So those are things I would encourage people. I do want to share on a human interest level that it was difficult rebuilding relationships with, you know, immediate and extended family that I had a minimal of contact with while I was incarcerated. But I've worked real hard at that. And, you know, I'm happy that, you know, my relationship with my mother is in a really good place now. And I'm much better terms with my extended family. One of the consequences was that there was a lot of guilt on their end that they didn't maintain contact with me, support me morale-wise, or contribute when several times, and my mother made rounds amongst the family and asked everybody to make a contribution that was within their means to pool money to hire legal representation. And, you know, everybody declined. So there was that part of it to work out on their end. And it was awkward for me talking with somebody that I know who they are intellectually from memories when I was younger, but yet they're adults now, they're a different person, and so am I. So that was awkward and difficult, but we've like worked past a lot of that in the 14 years that I've been home. So things are in a better place.
It seems that there's not one aspect of your life that hasn't been affected.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. You know, I would say the biggest challenge is now, you know, is just trying to put my life all together. I mean, I feel like career-wise, things have been really good. Education-wise, it's been great. And, you know, I have a really big body of work as an advocate. But the part that it still bedevils me some is just trying to put together a new social life with new people. That part is still difficult. I mean, I'm 46 now physically, but I feel more like if I'm 25, 26. So I still want to throw a ball around and, you know, let's go to an amusement park and, you know, let's go to new places and have new experiences and do new things. And most people my age, they did that already. You know, they're in a different walk of life. They're in a different stage of life. So who are my peers to do that with? And then also I'm able to do things that a lot of other people can't just from a financial point of view. And so at times it's gotten awkward if I'm, you know, when I socialize with some of the other exonerees that haven't yet been compensated or even people on parole that I knew while I was on the inside that are living crime-free lives now, many of them doing meaningful work, but you know, they're struggling financially. And so it becomes difficult because if Jeff doesn't pay for everything, nobody can afford to do anything. So that's been another awkward part of that. And you know, at times I've lost associations, relationships, however you want to phrase it, with people who see me as the answer to their financial problems. So I've had difficulties in that area also.
Sure. If people look at the amount of money that was awarded to you, they'll say, this guy's got some dough.
Right. Yeah, they think that. And then they think that you can make a lot more than what, you know, the market right now is doing like 2%. That's what you can make safely without taking a lot of risk. But people think that you make more than that. And I don't spend the principal of what I got because I know exactly what it's like not to have anything. You know, I was that way for 5 years out here where, you know, I was making $250 a week. So I know what it is not to have anything. And I don't ever want to go back to that. So the only thing I spend is whatever I earn. And that's, I don't touch the principal. And that doesn't make a lot. And so people don't think like that. They're just thinking when they ask me for one thing or another, they're thinking like, I'm just going to take some of the money and just hand it to them. And, you know, I can't do that. If I do that, you know, I'm going to wind up back with nothing. And I've heard horror stories of other, you know, exonerees and even people who've like won the lottery, you know, losing everything. So I'm determined not to let that happen to me.
That's a story.
Yeah. But, you know, just trying to make a change, just trying to make, you know, make a difference in the world and doing that the best I can. And I feel a strong moral obligation because I know that a lot of people in my position haven't had the same educational opportunities I've had and trying to be that voice for the voiceless. And I can't forget about the people that I metaphorically left behind. So that's why I do the advocacy work that I do.
And you're going to keep on doing it.
Absolutely.
Good for you. Well, I don't have any more questions.
Well, I believe at this point you're going to review a beer.
I picked you a good beer from a brewery in Queens. I've had a few of these beers.
All right. Yes, that's one of the aspects of your podcast that brings a smile to my face when I think about it. It's such an unusual twist to things, and I like new things, so this will be something new.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Jill, what are you burning out here? Bodies?
Well, no. I'm throwing in all of our earbuds and headphones with a little bit of lighter fluid as my protest against podcast ads in my favorite shows. I'm just getting into a story or I'm dozing off and it's interrupted with commercials. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Nice movie reference. Anyway, let's just simmer down here. You do know that our True Crime Brewery listeners have the option to subscribe to our premium show for ad-free episodes and bonus episodes, right? It costs as little as $4 per month, and these contributions help support the cost of producing TCB.
Well, of course. I love and appreciate our subscribers. You know, I worked for weeks with our IT girl to set that up, and all because I have a deeply held belief that our listeners shouldn't have to hear ads.
That's well said. Now, let me ask you this. How are we going to record this week's episode without our headphones?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, you stay here. I'll go get the hose.
Okay, hurry. Good job, Dickie. I really enjoyed that interview.
It was a good interview because Jeffrey's a good subject to talk to.
Yeah. Really added a lot of personal touches to the story.
Yeah, and the story, wow. I mean, it's kind of like the perfect storm of circumstances that got him there.
Kind of is, and then kind of the way he got out too, right? Just kind of a fluke. Or he'd still be in prison, which makes me think about how many more people are in prison that shouldn't be, you know? It's scary, and when I think about that, I think, can we really have a death penalty? Just executing one innocent person would be horrible.
It would. I've come around to the conclusion that I'd rather see them in prison for life without parole than put to death.
I think so. I mean, it's not like they're just put to death immediately.
No, there's all sorts of appeals and stuff to go through.
Right. So
I think they'd be better punished by keeping them in prison.
And just from my way of thinking, I don't think killing is ever an option that's really going to be productive or good for anyone.
Right.
But it really also just seemed really cruel to me how with the good cop, bad cop situation he was explaining, this one good cop kind of befriended Jeffrey to the point where he saw him as a father figure. I mean, that's sad. And then just imagine the feeling of betrayal he must have felt from
yeah,
that.
It's a horrible way to do it.
It is, yeah.
And I can't believe, I can because it happened, but, you know, how could his mother allow him to be interviewed by himself?
Yeah, I just think most people don't know any better. You really can't blame her. She wasn't a lawyer. She doesn't know any better. And hopefully people do know better now.
Well, we've long said that, and it's nice to hear Jeffrey say, get an attorney.
Yes, because we do know that at least in some states, I think most states, a minor can be interrogated without a parent or a lawyer there. And I do know if a minor asks for their parent, it's not the same as asking for an attorney. The questioning doesn't stop. The police can just say, yeah, well, your mom will be here later or something and continue to interrogate.
Right. If you say, I want a lawyer.
Yes, that's what you
stop.
Need to say.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. Although in these cases where it hasn't been recorded, I often wonder. Maybe
right.
They do say that. I mean, we have seen recorded interrogations where the person mentions a lawyer, says I should get a lawyer, or maybe I should talk to a lawyer, and
right.
That doesn't stop them.
No,
you have
doesn't.
To really ask for a lawyer.
You have to be very definitive about it.
Absolutely.
I want a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So.
But yeah, and the other thing is that suppose Jeanine Pirro wanted to be district attorney for life. He never would have gotten his DNA testing done.
Oh, my God. That's just a lot of power to give anyone. Yeah, also that makes me think of the judge when he was considering whether he wanted a bench or a jury trial. The judge tells the defense attorney that we're going to need to sit a jury because I don't want to be responsible for making this decision.
And the attorney,
outrageous.
Attorney doesn't do anything with that.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
And also it struck me, did he say there was no signed confession?
Right.
So how does that work?
Well, it's the cop's word against his.
Wow, that seems crazy to me.
It does.
You're really, I guess the overall thing that I take home with me from this is that you're really in the hands of strangers and they may not have your best interests in their mind.
They might not. I mean, their job is to get a suspect to confess.
Yes. Well, and I'm thinking of the defense attorney. Isn't his job to give him the best defense possible? Doesn't seem like that happens all the time.
No, it doesn't.
No. You know, if you think about our court system, if everyone got a trial, it would just stop right there. There's no way it could be done. Most people take a plea deal. So it seems like a lot of the attorneys are just trying to get things settled and move on to the next case, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah, there's pressure involved. You can't spend too much time on each case or on an individual case.
Well, yeah, I think especially if you're a court-appointed attorney.
Yep.
And you see the list of clients they have to deal with and the amount of time. It's really kind of impossible to do your job properly in some of these circumstances.
But it seems like he's come out of all this in fairly good shape.
Oh, yeah. I think it's remarkable. I'm really impressed with how he dealt with so much at such a young age on his own. I couldn't do it. No. I mean, to persist like that and come out of it, and then on top of it, not to be angry and bitter.
It'd be tough for me not to be angry and bitter.
Well, we're already angry and bitter, so.
Maybe that's the case.
Something like this would just make it worse, right?
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
I'd just be so unhappy and pissed off.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, you can only do that for so long, and then you have to accept what's going on and work your way out of it. And
yeah,
that's what he was able to do.
He was. I mean, I don't know that I'd be able to do that.
I don't think I would at all. So it is impressive.
Very.
Yeah. So thank you to Jeffrey Deskovic.
He was good. We might have to talk to him some other time.
Well, you know, this case is reminding me quite a bit of a case I think we're doing next month, the case of Angie Dodge. A lot of our listeners might have heard of this. It's been on Dateline or 48 Hours a few times, and it's another one with a false confession, and the DNA that was found of the guy that was convicted was not his, but they just kind of talked him into being an accessory.
Yep.
And he confessed, you know, the same kind of story, telling him he could go home and all that. He was alone. So very similar. So we'll see when we get to that. We might want to consult him, see what he has to say.
We might need some advice from
him. Yeah, absolutely right. So TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy listening to our shows, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. Also, if you visit our website, tiegrabber.com, you will find a shopping page where you can buy some of our brewery merch. We've got tees, tanks, and of course we have hoodies and other warmer stuff as autumn rolls in now. And we also have these cloth masks to help you feel safe and also tell people that you're a tie grabber. And of course you can also subscribe to our members-only show, True Crime Brewery Premium, on our website. As a member, you get a new bonus episode each and every month, ad-free versions of our weekly show, access to over 40 bonus episodes, and of course, a gift and a handwritten thank you note. And also, once you're a member, you don't have to listen to me pleading for you to sign up anymore.
Yeah, you'll be in the ad-free spot.
Ad-free person, that's right. All right, what have we got for feedback today?
We do have some feedback this week. I was kind of lazy last week and didn't do any, but I got some this week. So the voicemail is from Lindsay, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. It's Lindsay, a longtime listener. I know you don't like to receive compliments, but I'm going to give you one anyway. Really look forward to your episode coming out each week. Particularly like the way that you guys communicate with each other and the amount of respect you have for one another. That was really inspirational. And I was wondering if you guys are watching The Vow on HBO, like I am. It's about Nexium, and I don't mean the drug. It's just crazy. I'm from the Capital Region in upstate New York, and this gentleman was arrested in Clifton Park, which is an upscale neighborhood. And, you know, watching the story in the newspaper and now seeing it unfold on HBO is just crazy to think that this happened right here in our area. The most interesting part is that I've always had a misconception that people who ended up in cults, you know, must have something emotionally wrong with them, you know, or missing, that they would end up in that situation. And that's not what I'm seeing at all. It's really intelligent, articulate, successful people, and even actresses who fell for this stuff. So it's really super interesting. I'm interested in the psychology behind it, which I'm not seeing a lot of in the documentary. So I think it'll be something you guys might like to cover one day. And that's it. Thank you, guys.
Well, thanks, Lindsay. I just want to say, first of all, it's not that we don't like compliments. We love compliments. It's just I don't really feel like our listeners want to hear our praises over and over again. And, you know, I have a certain amount of self-loathing and criticism that makes it hard for me to deal with anything positive being said about me. So that's out of the way. And we did start watching The Vow, Dickie. Fascinating stuff. What have you got to say about that?
Well, we've seen a few episodes. I want to definitely keep watching it. It's a fascinating show. Lindsay says that it seems like regular people that get taken in by this, but I would also say that, yeah, they might be regular people, but there must be something that they think they're missing.
Yes.
To sign up for this charade.
Well, sure, but I mean, we all feel like we're missing something, right? So it doesn't make them different from any of us. It's just the way that they're dealing with it may be different than we would.
Okay, I'll give you that, because there's no way I would join this cult.
Probably not. No, I'm going to agree with you that you probably wouldn't fall for that. I'm thinking maybe if I was a single woman 20 years ago, I might have, you know? The thing is, when you're in it, it's much different than looking in from the outside, like anything else.
Sure.
But I guess the tip-off to me is whenever you have one person who's kind of godlike and everybody's looking up to them, and that's what this seems to be from the first couple episodes I saw, that's always like, hey, you're in a cult, right? Yeah. If there's somebody who's claiming to know things that nobody else knows, you're in a cult. And I can't wait to find out if any of those people who signed up, joined, whatever you want to call it, did a background check on this leader. Because a lot of the things they said about him, we're thinking are not true. We're thinking, that's a lot of bullshit going on there.
Probably embellished things a little. A
little bit. So, yeah, I can't wait to finish it. Really
we'll,
good.
We'll keep watching.
Absolutely.
The other thing with this type of situation, my bias against this is that the leaders of the cult, or whatever you want to call it, seems to me that their mission is to have sex with as many people as possible.
That happens a lot. You think that's where we're headed with this one? We haven't really got to that.
I would wager.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to give it away for anyone, but no. It is fascinating stuff.
It is.
So I appreciate Lindsay telling us about it.
Yeah.
Because I think I saw The Vow in my HBO on demand list when I was looking for something to watch, and I didn't know what the hell it was. At first, I thought it was that movie with Channing Tatum and Rachel McAdams. That's called The Vow. But then it was a documentary series, so quite different.
Figured it out.
Yeah. Okay. So we also have a case suggestion email from Patricia. Why don't you read that one for us?
Sure. You guys really make it seem easy, but honestly describing complex sagas in an entertaining, relaxed fashion. Always. Have you read A Killer Among Us? It's a terrible tale for a fascinating, true man-kills-wife tale. Great ending, too. Thanks for the fun. So without giving too much, if anything, away, Elizabeth DeCaro was a 28-year-old mother of four kids, found shot to death in her home. Her husband became an immediate suspect since he had accidentally struck her with a car not long before she was murdered, and this was after taking out a life insurance policy on her.
Wow.
And there's more, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, that's really ringing a bell. I might have heard of this or seen a true crime show about it. But I think it's something we're going to cover in the next couple of months. So good case suggestion, Patricia.
It's a good one. Then we have another case suggestion from Rob Paul.
All right. So Rob writes, love, love, love your podcast and would like to compliment you on your thorough research and ability to tell a gripping story from start to finish without losing the thread. Although I realize you're not fans of basking in compliments. Take that up with your shrinks. Well, that's probably good advice, at least for me. Yeah. I'd like to make a recommendation for a case I haven't seen covered in any other podcast. You say you like to cover dreadful cases, and this one has it in spades. It's the case of John de Blase. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. And his common law wife, Heather Keaton, who were both on death row in Alabama for the torture and murder of his two children, Natalie and Chase. It's both horrifying and haunting. I've never been able to get it out of my mind. You might need some brain bleach as well. But their story should be told because they simply deserve it for what they were put through. And that's a great point. I always feel that way. At first, when we started doing true crime, I was thinking maybe it's just a little bit exploitive. But then you have to think that these people that go through these horrible murders do deserve to be spoken about and remembered.
Right.
So he goes on, how did this ever happen without anyone catching on? I'm not a drinker, so I can't recommend a beer, but I think Dick is resourceful enough in this department. Please consider this case and otherwise continue on with your eminently listenable podcast. Well written. I enjoy that one. Good job, Rob. Thank you.
It was good. And there isn't, let's just say, these were his kids, not her kids, the common law wife. She was the step mother type of person.
Something seriously wrong with these people.
Yeah, the kids were like 3 and 4 years old, little boy and little girl.
That's horrible.
And they were tortured, poisoned, killed.
I don't think, I might not be able to do it.
I'll look up some more information on it, but and we'll see.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see what there is to it. But as far as what happened to those kids, I just can't spend too much time thinking about that. It's horrific.
It is.
And those are the kind of people that you really want to be put to death, right? You can say that the death penalty sounds like not the right thing to do. But then when you think of people like this, you just want to kill them yourself with your bare hands.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. Okay. We'll be off next week, but we will be putting out a premium episode in a few days. Then we'll be back the last week of September with another new episode. Thanks, everybody, for your feedback. We really appreciate it a lot. And of course, thank you as always for listening. And we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll be there and we'll save a seat for you.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.